Chair calls the Education Finance Committee to order for February 11th, 2025. Note, the legislative assistant will note there is a rule, or there is a quorum present. Welcome, members. We have a busy agenda today. We have quite a bit to get through. I'll thank Commissioner and Mr. Doge for being with us today, and we'll be getting to you shortly. We'll do some brief introductions to get to know each other a little bit. Before we go into those introductions, just a couple of things from the chair. Welcome. As we work through the task at hand, and we do have quite the task. One thing that I was able to do, fortunate in my early years, was to have a chair that had us mix it up in committee a little bit. And I would invite you, no seating chart today. I won't do any seating chart in the future. But I would invite you to find ways to sit across from each other and with each other and mingle. So whoever wants to break the ice at the Thursday meeting and switch that up a little bit, I think you'll find it's advantageous to talk into others that have equal perspectives as well. I would ask that as we go through this, just to remind everybody we're going through the chair. That will help expedite some of the conversation and keep us efficient, as well as just keep the decorum. So thank you for all that, and I hope that you'll have a little grace with me as we get our wings under us. And I'll always be looking over to my colleague, Representative Joaquim, from time to time to make sure we're getting it right. So with that, members, let's start with some brief introductions, and I'll start with you, Chair Joaquim.
What would you like us to just introduce our name and
Name, district, and just a quick snippet about yourself.
Oh, okay. I'm Representative Cheryl Joaquim. This is my 11th year. I represent 46B, which has changed a bit. I used to be all of Hopkins and half of St. Louis Park, but now I have Hopkins, two precincts in St. Louis Park, and a quarter of Edina. I have three districts that I represent, school districts in my boundaries, Hopkins, St. Louis Park, and Edina. And also quite a few different little charter schools and some private schools as well. So a little bit about me. I've lived in Hopkins for 28 years.
Thank you very much. Representative Clardy.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Mary Frances Clardy, and this is my second term. I'm excited to be here. When I'm not here, I am at a school. I am a teacher. So I love anything education. That's it.
Welcome, Representative. And I'm going to let you pronounce your name so I get those right. So,
mine's pretty easy. It's Julie Green. So
I'm sorry. What was that?
I represent District 50A, which is.
I actually didn't hear your name. I'm sorry. What was it?
Oh, Julie Green.
Thank you.
Why not? I'm working on it. I ask for grace a lot this first go around. So my name's Julie Green. I represent 50A, so most of Edina and a couple precincts in Bloomington. I'm a product of public schools. I grew up outside of Chicago, and I've lived in Minneapolis or Minnesota for the past nearly 19 years. I've got four kids that have come up and through the Edina public school system. And most recently, I served on the Edina school board from 2020 to the end of 2023. Most notably during the pandemic. So I will pass it along.
Thank you. Josiah Hill, I represent District 33B, which is Stillwater and surrounding communities from Bayport to the south and all the way up to portions of Forest Lake along the St. Croix River. Grew up in Stillwater, proud to serve constituents from that part of the world, and proud to be a career public education teacher, 25 years in the classroom. So thrilled to be with you.
Good afternoon, Representative Maria Isa Perez Vega. I represent where we're all sitting here today, St. Paul, Minnesota's 65B, as well as the wonderful suburb of West St. Paul. And it's been an honor to come back on my second term on this committee. I'm looking forward to continuing to work for our students from the earliest age to our off to higher ed, as well as the people who make our schools so great. The ones that dedicate their lives to these children, from our great teachers to staff and administration. I am a product of private school education. I was able to grow up right in my district on the west side, to St. Matthew's grade school, to St. Agnes in Frogtown, and then finishing my education in high school at St. Croix in West St. Paul. But I've also worked for several public school districts as well as reservations in Red Lake, and through cultural arts and endowments and history. So that I'm very passionate about history, very passionate for our social studies teachers, and I look forward to working with everyone here in this room. Thank you.
Representative Pete Johnson, District 8A, covering the central and western portions of Duluth up there. So I have the Duluth School District. I have one precinct that's in the Proctor School District, as well as private school and a couple of different charter schools in Edison and Harbor City. My day job, I'm a firefighter for the city up there. I've been doing that work for going on 20 years with the city of Duluth. My wife is an elementary school teacher in the Proctor Public Schools, and I got a couple of daughters in middle school. So they have all kinds of input on how they would like to see education go for them, and I'm sure they will be giving me plenty of feedback on my performance here. So happy to be here.
I'm Lucy Rehm. I am in my second term here. I represent 48B, which covers the Eastern Carver County Schools in Chaska and Chan, as well as Minnetonka. We also have World Learner Charter School in Chaska that I represent. I have three kids who have gone through the public school system, and I taught for about 5.5 years overseas, taught English as a foreign language.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Liz Lee. I represent the east side of St. Paul, so proud to be a colleague of Rep. Perez Vega, and I'm a proud product of the St. Paul Public Schools. This is my second term, so I've graduated, I like to say, from ed policy to ed finance, and really looking forward to diving more into the finances of making sure that we have a quality public education system for all students in Minnesota.
Hello, my name is Bianca Vernig. I represent 52B, which is Egan, Mendota Heights, Mendota. I'm a mother of three, former school board member, PTO mom, Lego League coach, and in my free time, I picked up subbing.
Hello, I'm Representative Carrie Ray Rauer. I'm representing 35B, which is the eastern half of Coon Rapids and two precincts of Andover. I am a former public school science teacher, life and earth science, taught 7th grade, 8th grade, 10th grade science, and then actually, little known is that I actually subbed for 3 years when my kids were small and I stayed home with them. So I've taught every grade, kindergarten through 12th, and have worked in four different school districts. So bringing all of those experiences to the table. Thank you.
Okay, let's come around to members on this side. Let's go on the inside. Representative DePell.
My name's Representative Tom DePell. I'm from Cottage Grove, and I represent Hastings, Denmark Township, and Ininger Township as well. I'm the board chair and founder of an academy in Woodbury, and also represent school districts 833 and 200. And I also want to give my condolences to the Jenny Wiederholt Pine family. She passed away suddenly. She's on the school board in Hastings, or was rather, and that definitively was a tragedy. We'll miss her greatly and appreciate her service.
And Representative Reimer, before we go to you, Representative Bonner, just so I don't get out of order.
Sorry about that. I went to the wrong room. I am State Representative Kristen Bonner of Maple Grove.
And something quick about yourself?
Quick about myself, I am serving my fourth term. Love Maple Grove. We have the second largest amount of retail outside of the Mall of America.
Thank you very much. Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Max Reimer. I represent District 28B, which is Chisago County. In my district are the North Branch Schools and the Chisago Lake Schools. I'm a product of public school. My two oldest go to public school right now. And when I'm not legislating, I'm a small business owner. Own a digital marketing agency that works with real estate agents, and we just started a mortgage company 2 years ago. So excited to be on this committee and figure out how we can make our education system better for all the kids.
Hi, everyone. State Representative Pam Altendorf. I'm from District 20A, which is by Red Wing. Five children, all graduated 19 to 31, and they graduated from Goodhue Public Schools.
Hello, Chair. Representative Krista Knudsen from House District 5A, which includes portions of Becker, Wadena, Hubbard, and Cass counties. I have four children that are all currently in public school from kindergarten to seventh grade. My husband and I also are restaurant owners.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Lawrence. I represent House District 27B, which is Princeton, Zimmerman, and St. Francis, three different school districts in my area there. I've got four children that all have gone to the Princeton public school system and done very, very well. My youngest is graduating this year, so I've got a senior that I'm chasing through this final year of school, and so I'm just glad to be on the Education Committee.
Hi, I'm Dwayne Quam, 24A. Got all or part of nine school districts, including three that are in the bottom six per pupil funded in the state of Minnesota. Been on the school board, been on the Zumbro Education District Governing Board. Have worked with about three dozen different schools, corporate initiative, business initiative, tutored, volunteered, and I'm here to make things better.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Patricia Mueller from Austin, Minnesota, in 23B, and I wrote them down just so I didn't forget anyone because last time I forgot someone. So represent Austin School District, Grand Meadow, Lyle, Southland, Blooming Prairie. I have kiddos that go to Hayfield, and I have two private schools of Sacred Heart and Pacelli. School teacher, still active school teacher for 20 years, middle school, high school English, also married to a teacher, don't have any children, but do have two crazy one-year-old labs, because why only adopt one? You need to have two, named Lincoln and Reagan. Really excited about really beefing up literacy this year.
Hey everybody, Elliot Engen. I represent District 36A, which is Lionel Lake, Centerville, Circle Pines, White Bear Township, and North Oaks. We also have one precinct that overlaps with the Forest Lake School District, Centennial School District, and White Bear Lake. So I do not work in a school, but it wasn't that long ago that I graduated from one, 2017, so we can all laugh at that. But I'll pass it on from there. Thank you.
Representative Engen, you didn't have to tell your age with "Hey, everybody, we all knew." Representative Hudson.
Representative Walter Hudson from District 30A in northeastern Wright County. I have primarily the St. Michael Albertville School District, but also portions of the Rockford Schools, Elk River Schools, and a snippet of the Monticello Schools. Two sons who are making their way through STMA schools in middle school and high school, and have been engaged long before obtaining elected office in issues related to financing of our schools, which are similar to Representative Quam's in terms of being amongst the lowest in per pupil funding. So looking forward to getting to work.
Hello, everyone. I'm Peggy Bennett. I represent District 23A, that's southern Minnesota, Albert Lea being the largest city in that district where I also live. I am a retired teacher. I taught for 33 years, mostly first grade, a little bit of special ed. And there are five school districts that reside directly within my legislative district and three private schools. And just a little bit of trivia, my previous Shiloh Shepherd, and those of you who know me know I'm an animal person. There's my dog right there. I have dogs and cats. Those are my fur kids. I also have over 750 kids, my former students. But a little trivia, I taught my previous Shiloh Shepherd how to read some basic words, and he used to come into my first grade classroom for his birthday every year and show the kids how he could read, and he really could, so.
My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the privilege to represent the communities of and the school districts of Prior Lake, Jordan, Shakopee, and then Southwest Metro Intermediate District as well. And then a host of private schools. My wife and I have been blessed with three kids. My daughter is 20 and is at Dunwoody Institute studying interior design. My middle son Brock is 18 and he is at Bethel. I think he's majoring in football and going to class every once in a while. And then my 11-year-old son is a sixth grader in the school that I'm a principal of. So, Representative Johnson, I'm sure our middle schoolers will be evaluating us well. So, you know, I'm passionate about education. It's what I've spent my entire career doing, like many of you in the room, and really look forward to working together to find solutions, because our schools are struggling, and we need to all recognize that, and we all need to move forward together to find consensus. One of the top priorities for me is going to be attendance and truancy, and how do we ensure that kids are in school? Because if they're in school, they're not out on the street causing issues. And if they're in school, they're going to be learning reading and math. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Bakeberg will be our vice chair. And then depending on how things go, Representative Clardy will be possibly the co-vice chair when we get back to that arrangement with Representative Joaquim. And we have one remote member, Representative Sensenmuir. Polly, if you would like to bring her in.
Everyone, I don't know if you're, are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Representative Samantha Sensenmuir. I represent District 63A in the House, which is part of South Minneapolis. This is my second term on the Education Finance Committee. I have a background of working in education in both in-school and out-of-school programming. Most recently, I was the executive director of a literacy nonprofit in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm a proud product of Minneapolis Public Schools and future Minneapolis Public Schools parent. I have two kids. My daughter was born last month, so I have a one-year-old, which is why I'm home with her, but we'll hope to be back with you all in person soon.
Very well. Thank you, and congratulations with the new addition to the family. Nonpartisan staff, we have Mr. Strom, Ms. Para, and Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Chair Krisha. I'm Tim Strom, and it's my pleasure to be here again this year. This is my 42nd year with the legislature, and I couldn't ask for a better place to work.
Thank you, Chair Krisha. Christina Pera from House Research, staff education policy and the Education Finance Committee, and this is my 9th session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. I've been here, this will be my 7th session, and in addition to education finance, I also staff commerce finance.
Thank you. One of the finest staffs, and we're lucky to have all of you, so thank you. Partisan, let's start on the Democrat side, DFL side.
Hi, I'm Mars Beltrandi-Rudquist. I'm the DFL caucus researcher for this committee and the Education Policy Committee.
Again, welcome.
Hello, everyone. Polly Sikvenik, DFL committee staff. At this current time, I'm Mr. Withers' counterpart.
And let's go.
I'm Janelle Bulk. I've been with the House for 10 years and in state government for 20.
Jody Withers, House Republican Caucus. I've been here about 1/4 the time as Tim Strom, so that makes me about 1/8 as smart.
And thank you for everyone here. And we have... Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies.
I'm Robin Schmidt. I'm a CLA. I've been at the legislature since 21 and happy to be here. Thank you.
Welcome. Sorry. And we have, did I miss anybody else? Jacob, excuse me.
I'm Jacob Cowan. This is my 3rd year with the House and I staff this committee as well as taxes.
Anybody else? I'm excited to get to the pages, so... we have two pages for our committee. We have Connor and Natalie. If you could stand up and do a quick introduction of where you're from.
I'm Connor Beckles. My 2nd year as a page, my 2nd year on the Education Finance Committee, and I'm from Mankato.
Yep. I'm Natalie Walrus. This is also my 2nd year as a page, but my 1st year on Education Finance, and I'm from Cornell.
And Mr. Beckel, do you have anything else to add? You have a very proud person sitting here. I can call you out and embarrass you, or you can do it yourself. How would you like to do it? Well, welcome. Well, thank you, members. A couple quick things before we turn it over and we head to the governor's budget recommendations, and we have testifiers for that. In your packets, you have the Today folder. If this is new to you, that will cover all the materials that you have for the meeting. You'll find a copy of the rules, which shouldn't be a big surprise. No changes, not much changing. Is there any changes from the past? No. So very similar to what you've seen under Chair Joaquim. So, and then with that, there will be materials and handouts that we'll have from the commissioner and his staff. So just to give you a lay of the land, we do have quite a few testifiers today. So we'll give Commissioner Jett, Ms. Erickson, and Mr. Uni their time, and then get through the public testimony. We're going to try to get about 30 to 35 minutes for that, and then get to member discussion and questions at about 2:15. We'll see how well we can hold to that agenda. So with that, Commissioner Jett, welcome, and thank you for your patience while we work through all of the housekeeping items. So please introduce yourself and who you brought with you for the record, and you are ready to proceed with your presentation. And members, I would just ask that write your questions down. Let's hold those to the end so we can allow him the continuity of getting through the presentation. So with that, welcome Commissioner Jett.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Willie Jett, and I have the pleasure to serve as the Commissioner of Education here in our great state of Minnesota, and I enjoyed listening to the introductions, excuse me, and getting to know where everybody is from their pets to their children to being from West Side of Chicago or Maple Grove and things of that nature. That was interesting for me, and some of you, I have some things to talk about or some things in common. So with that, thank you for the opportunity for the Department of Education to present the Governor's 2025 budget. With me today to present the budget, I have Director of School Finance, Ms. Kathy Erickson, and Director of Government Relations, Mr. Adosh Uni. I also have Assistant Commissioners Angela Mansfield and Bobby Burnham. They're out in the crowd. They're also here to present in case detailed program questions arise in their respective programs. So 2023-2024 were monumental legislative sessions where together the state progressed significantly in a range of critical education programs on behalf of Minnesota's students, educators, families, schools, and communities. Just to highlight a few of the fundamental investments made, we provided an automatic inflator for the general education formula, providing more assurance for our schools that additional flexible funding for all programming will be coming each year. We made significant gains in supporting our students who receive special education services, making up for the funding the federal government has continually not provided. And we made sure no child is hungry while at school by making sure that all students are entitled to a free breakfast and lunch during the school year. And with this, we also boosted compensatory revenue, which funds programs for our most underserved students. We boosted resources for our English learners and historically underfunded student group. And in 2027, we will be funding the EL cross subsidy at 25%. The legislature made massive advances in literacy education with the READ Act, completely reforming how students are taught reading and investing in educator training. We worked together and with DEED to open the unemployment insurance during the summer term for hourly school workers for the first time. This provides these staff members with more viable positions from year to year. And I'd like to thank you for providing more dedicated resources for our American Indian students, some of our most underserved in the state. We also know that Minnesota has some of the worst support personnel to student ratios in the country. And that is why aid to support the hiring of these staff members and the pipeline program to recruit more are so essential for our students' well-being. Now, the November forecast has laid an important task ahead of us. How do we maintain our priorities to fund Minnesota's public education system on behalf of our students and educators with the responsibility to balance our state's budget? The governor's 2025 education budget proposes to do just that. It balances a narrow set of urgent and prioritized needs with ideas on how we can reach a balanced budget. I also want to address the proposed reductions at the top of this point of my remarks. So let me be clear, as the governor has stated, this is a starting place for a conversation around this incredibly important and difficult task. The budget proposes reductions to QCOMP, special education transportation aid, and non-public education aid streams as a starting place for a conversation. The governor, MDE, and I welcome other balanced solutions that also maintain the important strides that we have made. Addressing the investments the governor proposes, I believe that these are necessary and doable, and I'd like to mention a few of the other big items with the committee. The governor has proposed an enterprise-wide fraud prevention and program integrity initiative. This budget provides critical staffing and software to enhance our legal capacities to support the more effective delivery of resources for our students and protect our taxpayers' dollars. As I mentioned, in 2023, we provided a significant investment for our most underserved students by boosting compensatory revenue. However, we recognize that work needs to be done to maintain this investment on a more stable trajectory. So we propose a one-time boost to the program and task a working group to recommend a solution for future years. Providing hourly workers, extremely important members of our education teams, with viable positions and meeting their needs is critical for our students' education. And in the beginning phase of unemployment insurance for hourly workers during the summer term, one-time additional funding is needed to help our programs and our schools successfully continue to meet their obligations under this program. So, continuing the good work done under the READ Act, it makes sense for us to look at where resources are needed the most. That is why we are proposing to revise literacy incentive aid to be based on which students need the most assistance. And so our team will provide a more detailed overview of the items I mentioned, as well as a tailored set of other proposals we believe are important for Minnesota's education system. We believe that this is a balanced package that maintains the monumental progress made in the past few years for Minnesota students, educators, families, and schools, and that it provides necessary funds for critical programs, and it opens up the conversation for difficult decisions we must make together. And so I'd like to thank you for your time, and with that, I will hand it off to my colleagues, Mr. Adosh Uni and Ms. Kathy Erickson.
Mr. Uni.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Department of Education. Ms. Erickson and I are going to cover in more detail the proposals laid out in the Governor's 2025 education budget proposals, and we'll switch off a little bit, but I'll start out, and then Ms. Erickson will cover a bulk, and then there may be some switches in between. So apologies for the back and forth, but that's the best way to go in terms of content expertise. So just to lay the context, I know many of the members here, and I've heard from probably nonpartisan staff about what the context in which we find ourselves. As the commissioner mentioned, with the 2024 November forecast, we do find ourselves with a $616 million projected balance in the 26-27 biennium, and then a $5.14 billion projected shortfall in the 28-29 biennium. And the governor's budget proposal reflects a balanced approach toward meeting this goal. As the commissioner mentioned, maintaining the priority strides we made for the priorities in the past few years, while also making some proposals to meet the task of coming up with a balanced budget. And so you'll see in the table listed at the top, we do have some mostly one-time increases to the funds, and you'll see that mostly built through the proposals in compensatory revenue and the unemployment insurance program. And then there are some small ongoing funding asks going forward into future years into the tails as well. But the bulk of the fiscal portion of the proposals is in reductions. You can see in fiscal year 26, it's a $71 million reduction, and then $184 in fiscal 27, $172 in fiscal 28, and $173 in fiscal 29, for a resulting total change of a $5 million, roughly, increase in fiscal 26, but then between $178 million and $170 million per year in fiscal 27 through fiscal 26. For the governor's proposal in detail, the first we want to highlight is the fraud prevention and program integrity package. The governor shares this priority with everyone at the legislature and the public in terms of improving program integrity and preventing fraud. In 2023, the governor put forward the proposal around creating a statutorily mandated Office of Inspector General at the Department of Education. The legislature provided support for that. And then last year, we came forward with some language, and many thanks to many members here around the table for their hard work on enhancements to the Office of Inspector General's authorities around, again, in supporting program integrity and preventing fraud. We know the Office of Inspector General is hard at work, has staffed up, and has oversight over many programs that we oversee across the agency. The proposal in this governor's package seeks to enhance that further, as well as enhance our Office of General Counsel, which started in 2021 and has grown to meet the demands that the agencies have. We have found year over year that more divisions have more legal needs as they navigate not only state statute, but the requirements under federal law, and as programs become more complex and they oversee more programs. So the specific proposal is $550,000 annually for three FTEs and software dedicated to these goals of fraud prevention and program integrity. One is for an Office of Inspector General investigator, and this will increase the capacity of the OIG to investigate fraud, waste, and abuse and to address complaints faster. There'll be two legal counsels. One will be focused on charter schools, so assisting our charter center in providing legal advice and supporting that the agency effectively exercises the required oversight of charter schools and addresses program integrity and related challenges. And this will be balanced with many of the proposals that we'll be having coming in our policy bill around charter schools as well. And then there'll be one legal counsel, again, run out of the general counsel's office, but that will be dedicated to helping the nutrition team navigate with legal advice and navigate not only state law, but regulatory authority as well under over nutrition programs, but also operating under federal programs as well. And then the final component is around software that we'll need for the OIG, so the Office of Inspector General, to conduct in-depth investigations and for advanced software to combat fraud, waste, and abuse, and also to track cases and conduct financial analysis of programs. And with that, I will pass the next few slides off to my colleague, Ms. Erickson.
And Ms. Erickson, if you could say your name for the record, and then please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathy Erickson, and I'm the Director of School Finance at the Minnesota Department of Education. The slide that I'll start with is the provision that would extend a hold harmless for our compensatory revenue calculation. The governor is recommending a modification for fiscal year 26 only. It would use the greater of fiscal year 24 pupil counts or fiscal year 26 pupil counts. Often when we think of a hold harmless, we might think of funding or money, but we're actually freezing student counts to build into the calculation. In addition, this would be under the current calculation that we're using for the fiscal 25 hold harmless, which would include both paper forms and direct certification. Right now, if there is no change going into fiscal year 26, there would be a new formula that would be using direct certification only counts to calculate compensatory revenue for fiscal years 26 and beyond. The formula would use those same components and again would be an investment of approximately $39.7 million in fiscal year 26 and then $4.4 million in fiscal year 27, which is our 90-10 calculation. So the cleanup payment is what you would see in fiscal year 27. In addition, the governor recommends a creation of a working group to study various compensatory revenue calculations and determine if we are able to find a more consistent calculation that would reduce some of the variables that we're currently seeing going forward with the direct certification only. Again, this would be a hold harmless for 1 year as a recommendation from the governor. For the unemployment insurance aid, the governor is recommending an investment of $30 million into the special revenue fund that was originally funded at $135 million. This would be in order for in fiscal year 26 that all districts would receive full funding in state aid and we would avoid a proration. You can see here that our disbursement so far for fiscal or estimated disbursements are $102 million of the $135 million for last year, fiscal year 24, and estimated fiscal year 25, which leaves the fund with just $33 million left to start fiscal year 26.
Our estimated summer UI costs for fiscal year 26 are approximately $63 million, which is how we get to the investment of $30 million. So that allows, at that time, 100% aid to be distributed for fiscal year 26. Proration causes some struggles with certain districts and certain abilities to use other funding sources once the revenue is exhausted. So this is our recommendation, is to make sure that we can go through the entire fiscal year with state aid to cover that cost through fiscal year 26. Others going into the future would need to be discussed for future consideration for whether there's aid or other funding sources for UI going past fiscal year 26. And again, this would be funding that would go into the special revenue fund to cap it off and make sure that we're able to cover all the costs for fiscal year 26. We also are revising the literacy incentive aid formula by eliminating the MCA test proficiency and growth as one of the factors and replacing it with poverty data. As Adosh Uni mentioned, that we are looking at a recalculation that would use a poverty based calculation, and we would then be making this revenue neutral to the amount of the allocation. So we would have the same entitlement, but we would be using a different formula to make sure that funding goes to where the needs are the most around the state. The governor is also proposing an adjustment to the special education transportation reimbursement. For state special education, we distribute funding based on reimbursements of expenditures, not entitlement programs based on pupil counts like many of our other funding sources are. So for school year, fiscal year 26, which would be next year, the eligible transportation costs would be reimbursed at a 95% rate rather than traditionally right now it would be considered 100%. But I do want to note that the complexity of the special education formula and other hold harmlesses can oftentimes in the end not fully fund all of the categories for individual districts based on their categories. But overall, we would be taking 95% of those eligible transportation costs going into the formula for reimbursement. And then for fiscal years 27 and beyond, the percentage reimbursement for state special education transportation eligible costs that are submitted to MDE would be 90%. And this would result in a reduction in fiscal years 26 and 27 of approximately $48.6 million. And then for the second biennium, 28-29, would be approximately $54.9 million in reductions that we would not be paying out just in relation to special education transportation. In addition, we are looking, and the governor is recommending, to eliminate the non-public pupil aid starting in fiscal year 26. This would also include that school district obligations for those programs would also be eliminated. There are three basic categories of non-public pupil aid that you can see on the slide, which includes textbooks, individualized materials, and standardized tests in one category, health services or school nurses in the second category, and guidance and counseling services in the third category. By no longer funding this portion of non-public pupil aid would result in a $52.5 million reduction in the general fund and $56.4 million in the second biennium of 28 and 29. In addition, non-public pupil transportation aid would also be eliminated. This again is a obligation of school districts if non-public schools determine that they need transportation to their sites. This would result in a reduction of $56.2 million in fiscal years 26 and 27 and an additional $58.4 million in the second biennium 28 and 29. The governor is also recommending the elimination or closure of the Alternative Teacher Compensation Program, otherwise known as QCOMP, starting in fiscal year 27. There is estimated approximately 111 school districts and 71 charters. Again, this is an estimate we have some changing over time, including an intermediate district and education district implementing QCOMP right now. districts would receive revenues associated with fiscal years 26. There would be a cleanup payment for that aid distribution in fiscal year 27, but overall the program would be ending June 30th, 2026. Also, because there is a levy component to QCOMP or alternative teacher compensation, there would also be one levy adjustment that would happen on the payable 26 levy for fiscal year 27 disbursements to close out those pieces. Last year, the legislature did create a reserve fund balance for alternative teacher compensation or QCOMP, and the language would require that any reserve funds that are being carried over, starting with last fiscal year 24, and into fiscal year 25 and 26, would need to be used for teacher incentive pay until those funds are exhausted. So any district that is carrying any reserve fund balances for that program would need to use that under those guidelines. And this would result in a reduction of $78.7 million in fiscal year 27, and then $173.1 million in fiscal years 28 and 29. There would also be a reduction in the overall levy of approximately $39.5 million starting in fiscal year 27. And I'll turn it back over to my colleague, Adok.
Mr. Rooney.
Mr. Chair, members, carrying on from Ms. Erickson, I'm going to go into several proposals that are no-cost proposals. The first two here are both transfers from the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, or PELSB, over to the Minnesota Department of Education. The first is the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color Grant. This program has been around since 1997. It transferred to PELSB in 2019. About 2 years ago, within MDE, we brought together several divisions to create a centralized educator workforce center that's very much focused on all things educator support, recruitment, retention, professional development. And so we're really well positioned to assume both of these programs. Speaking specifically to this program, or CUGMEC, in addition to the transfer, it's going to bring over 0.8 FTE equivalents from PELSB, again, at no cost. But in addition to this, the proposal also removes some barriers to participation in the program. We're removing a complicated formula and moving to a $5,000 cap, which allows the recipients to be able to navigate in the space and be able the flexibility to be able to assign the funds as necessary to meet their needs and their program needs. There's going to be more balance in the geographic distribution between the metro and greater Minnesota as well. Moving on to the transfer of the Teacher Mentorship and Retention Program, PELSB began this program in 2019, and the grants have gone to stipends for mentoring teachers and induction programming and supporting affinity groups and teacher financial support to add additional licenses. In 2022, MDE began work on a mentorship and induction model with federal ARP funds. So again, with that funds, we're very well set up to take on this program. Within the funds that we've already received, including 2023 funds from the legislature, we were able to create an induction framework, piloted it, and revised it with public results. And then we also administered the statewide induction program with the funds that we received from the legislature in 2023. So again, we're really well positioned to take on this program as well as the CUGMEC program with our experience with those programs as well as the Educator Workforce Center. Moving on to student support personnel, we are looking to adjust some uses for the student support personnel aid. Just as a reminder, there was originally student support personnel aid to help in 2016 and 17 one time and then funded on an ongoing basis in 2023. This is an aid flow to LEAs to be able to bring on student support personnel like school counselors, school nurses, school psychologists, school social workers, and chemical dependency counselors in the school setting. The proposals that we're making here, one is to be able to allow the aid to be directed directly to cooperative units rather than flowing through member districts, and then also allow local education agencies, or LEAs. You can hear me say LEAs a lot, so local education agencies, charters, districts, cooperatives, intermediates, who are unable to hire student support personnel to use the funding for maintaining the position if they're going to be lost for declining enrollment, cover the costs of planning and implementing job embedded coaching, and covering the materials of evidence-based culturally responsive curricula and programs. And then there's going to be a simple technical change to the student support personnel pipeline name to student support personnel pathway grant. Moving on to American Indian Education, we are looking to help tribal contract or tribally controlled schools be eligible for all grants. Tribally controlled schools are federally designated public schools that are overseen by the Bureau of Indian Education, but they do have some place in our state laws. They are eligible for certain grants. They aren't spelled out as eligible in every single grant. Because of how they sit in the federal public space and are not technically the same as district charters, intermediates, and co-ops, stating districts and charters in a grant opportunity does not automatically make tribally controlled schools eligible, except where they are explicitly listed. And so we are looking to have a revisor instruction to have tribally controlled schools be eligible for all grants that districts, charters, intermediates, and co-ops are. They serve students as a public school or as a state designated public school would. They have to accept all students and they have to comply with all accountability requirements under federal and state laws. And so they should be eligible for grant opportunities just as districts, charters, intermediates, and co-ops are. The other program that we're looking under American Indian Education to make an adjustment to is the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program. This is a program to increase the number of American Indian teachers in our schools. It is a collaboration, or the funds go towards a collaboration between districts and a higher ed institution. Four collaborations are named explicitly in statute, and then in recent years we've got enough money to run a competitive program, and so there's, I think, two or three other additional collaborations that are also there but not listed in statute. But one of the things we've heard about is that some candidates come out of the program and then ultimately teach in the higher ed setting. The intention of the program was always for them to be set to be teaching in the K-12 or E-12 setting, and so we're just going to be making a tweak to the statute to make it clear that candidates that come out of the program should be teaching in the K-12 or E-12 setting. I'm just going to pass it off to my colleague, Ms. Erickson, to just touch on this top one, and then I'll take it back.
Very good. Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're clarifying the lease levy statute, which includes adding a subdivision of definitions to better clarify the use of the lease levy funds and the processes that define the differentiation between operational and capital leases, as well as some joint leases, and to clarify that there is the eligibility for a review and comment for a lease that is over $2 million. So that part is in the definition section. The second area is to provide more clarity that there is a process that's currently in statute that we do not use anymore, which is to evaluate the district's operating capital revenue in order to determine a lease levy approval. Now that we have a per pupil amount that's in statute, which we're not intending to change at this time, that piece of clarity in terms of an approval for a lease is no longer needed. And then finally, we are just hoping to provide more validity and transparency to the lease levy process so that all folks that are associated with that will have an understanding of the process and the process in which we at MDE approve those leases. Thank you.
Ms. Journey?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the next program is a modification that we're proposing to the Achievement and Integration Program and Administration. Just as a little bit of a background for the committee, this program enhances racial and economic integration in public schools, boosts achievement, and reduces educational disparities. Qualifying LEAs are racially isolated, join a district that is racially isolated, and then volunteer to join the program, or have racially identifiable schools. And just for some context of why some of the adjustments are necessary, in 2003, there were 53 LEAs. In 2025, so this year, there are 180. So the increase of the program is very significant over the existence of the program. We operate it at MDE with just three FTEs equivalent, and they provide coaching, technical assistance, and training to all 180 participants. The proposal does the following. So it increases the set aside for MDE to support the program from 0.3% of the current funding to 1.3%, and this will increase our 2.2 current FTE. We do supplement that with an additional 0.8 FTE for three FTEs, as I mentioned, who are working on it. The 0.3% is equivalent to about 2.2 FTE. This will increase it to about 5.8 FTE to support FTEs, fund training and coaching for MDE and LEAs, increase MDE capacity to partner and support data collection and monitoring. The other proposals in this are in response to OLA recommendations. There was an OLA report several years ago to enhance program effectiveness. And so we propose that instead of MDE using 20%, if an LEA isn't of their funding, if an LEA isn't meeting their goals, their three-year goals, it would have MDE direct the LEAs to implement improvement plans. So instead of MDE basically telling districts this is what you specifically have to do, we would work in collaboration more with the districts to be able to implement their own plans, and this is in line with one of the OLA recommendations. The next item, two items we have are in the nutrition space. The first is around nonprofit food expenditures. We are making an adjustment to that the funds can only be used, and again, rest of these ones that I'm covering except for the final couple slides will be no-cost proposals. We're saying that funds in this account can only be used for purposes that are tied directly to the nonprofit food service account. So the prevailing example is administration time for supervision of a lunchroom can't be tied, or any supervision can't be tied to this account unless the supervision is a primary job duty of that administrator. We're also revising the responsibility of a deficit in the account from the food service management account company to directly to the district. The last program in nutrition is repurposing a small existing summer food service program incentivization fund. It's about $150,000. It's currently used to incentivize summer food service program, SFSP, sponsor participation to instead be distributed to schools for work on uploading data to the summer electronic benefit transfer system. And that's a program that allows families to access weekly funds for food security during the summer. The current use of the funds, that $150,000 for incentivization, is inadequate. It's not a whole lot of money for the sponsors to be able to use to be incentivized in. The funding comes in December when the participants are already engaged in some internal auditing, and so this just makes it a cumbersome process to pursue the incentivization funds. Over the last 2 years, with the creation of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, there have been transfers of programs from the Department of Education, various other agencies, over to the new agency. And with that, last year there were some additional changes that needed to catch up with that, transfers of funds. This year we have a few more authorities that we need to formally transfer over to the department, or to DCYF, and these are technical, no-cost transfers or clarifications in law around authority. They're the alignment of federal reimbursement for administrative costs, administrative ability to transfer funds between MDE and DCYF. There are some programs that they oversee, but that we do run some of the programs, like voluntary pre-kindergarten is an example. We're aligning authorities to manage forecast appropriations, and then transferring authority for some additional or some educational aides that will be overseen.
Another program from another agency that we do receive some funding that doesn't come out of the education target, but that you should be aware of, is the Service to Success Initiative out of Deed. It's creating a Office of Public Service, and they're going to be doing a one-time $150,000. It's a temporary FTE, $150,000 to the department to have an FTE to work to help with workforce development and focused on increasing access to the public service career pathway. And so this FTE would focus on identification, alignment, and extension of career pathways existing between or within the secondary and adult basic education settings, and then they would help align transitions between secondary, post-secondary, and workforce settings as well. And again, this is a multi-agency effort, and this is just one small component within this overall effort in the governor's budget. There are a few agency initiatives that we have here. One is around legal services costs. It's a one-time $6 million ask to support legal costs. The funds would cover staffing for MDE's Office of General Counsel. We currently have temporary funds set aside for that office. Again, they are very critical to MDE's ability to navigate the legal environment across all of our programs. They spend all day providing legal advice as well as interpretation advice across their divisions, as well as work collaboratively with the Attorney General's office on complex litigation that we've had going on sometimes for many years. The staffing that this would cover are our actual general counsel, deputy general counsel, and then a portion of our compliance officer, and then funding to cover litigation would be standard litigation costs that the Attorney General incurs, like discovery, like courtroom costs, reports, those things of that nature. And then our other proposal is around our operating adjustment. This is $677,000 in fiscal 26 and $1.365 million in years thereafter. This would cover increasing operating costs like the growth in employment compensation and insurance, rent, IT services, and other operating costs. This proposal would also include the ability to retain up to 10% of competitively awarded grants if administrative funding has not been provided, and also to carry forward unexpended non-grant operating operations from the end of the biennium into the next. I believe there's three grants currently that have been existing for a while where we would ask for that 10%. And I can get the names of them. I just don't have them on the top of my head if that is a follow-up question, but I think there's three that we've identified at this point. I believe that is all that we have for the committee, Mr. Chair.
Okay. If you can sit tight for a second. So, members, I'm going to ask Ms. Beckel if she'll go over the House fiscal analysis spreadsheet quickly, and then I'll have you sit by as we work through the public testimony, and then we can get to the questions. So, do you have a – you're good for now? Ms. Beckel? So, members, Minnesota House Fiscal Analysis Spreadsheet in your packet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. There is a spreadsheet titled in the upper left-hand corner, K through 12 Education Finance, Governor's Recommendations, Jan 2025, Aid Appropriation Summary. So this spreadsheet should look familiar to some of you. There is the November forecast numbers on the left-hand side. So first you see the program description or the division description. Then you see the November forecast. So those are base numbers. Those will be updated soon with the February forecast numbers, and then those will become the base numbers. And then the columns that are on the right with the title GovRex show the governor's recommendations. And so the agency staff just walked through those recommendations, but those are the ones that have a fiscal impact are shown here on the spreadsheet. And I won't go through every last one, Mr. Chair, but I will just show you how to read those. So if you look, for example, at line 9, that says compensatory revenue modification. And that should be highlighted on your spreadsheet because that is a governor's recommendation. You will see zeros in the November forecast area because that's a new proposal, so it's not in the base.
But if you move over to the governor's recommendations, you'll see that in fiscal year 2026, the governor is recommending spending of $39.77 million, and then in fiscal year 27, spending of $4.419 million. And that's that compensatory revenue modification, including those paper forms once more, working on that hold harmless situation that the agency staff went over. And later down this spreadsheet, you can see that compensatory working group that the agency talked about, that $94,000 in fiscal year 26, that you can find under the state agencies section of the spreadsheet. But so if you're looking for those costs for the governor's recommendations, just look for the highlighted program item and then look over to the right side of the spreadsheet for those costs.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. So if you have any questions on that, we'll have time to come back and we'll handle that as we get through that. So thank you, Ms. Beckel. And with that, thank you, Commissioner, Mr. Uni, and Ms. Erickson. If you can stand by, we're going to get through the list of testifiers, and then we want to be able to get to our member questions and discussions. So I'd like to do two at a time. I'll call you up. If I don't have your names, I'll probably call you by organization so you get a chance to do your name. You get a chance to pronounce your name, so I get that right. So, and if you keep your testimony to a couple minutes, and we're going to try to do this in about a half an hour if possible. Mr. Shaver and Ms. Schneider, Ed Allies and Education Minnesota, you're up. And on deck will be Ms. Nisler and Mr. Kroonquist. And Mr. Shaver, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, and away we go.
Making me go first. Chair Carisha, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver. I'm a teacher and the senior policy director at Ed Allies. We're education advocates who partner with students, families, educators, and communities to push for policies that improve outcomes for kids. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to share our perspective on Governor Wall's budget priorities. Our state is facing a tough budget situation, and in light of that, organizationally, we support policies that prioritize student need and take a hard look at whether investments currently being made are positively impacting students. And if not, we support efforts to get creative and innovative with how to ensure that we align limited dollars with urgent priorities and target those resources in a fair and efficient way. We have one ongoing funding stream dedicated to the implementation of the READ Act, Literacy Incentive Aid. In the decade plus of its existence, around $500 million have been sent through this funding stream, and the reality is that our MCA reading scores are worse than when it started. If you look at the distribution, the formula rewards big districts and penalizes small districts. It gives schools less money to provide literacy supports for struggling readers because they have so many struggling readers. At the same time, this specific proposal from the governor to distribute literacy incentive aid solely on student poverty does need work and also misses an important opportunity to revisit its uses and consider how to maximize the ability for districts to prioritize those dollars while still under the umbrella of the goals of the READ Act. We support change in the way we think about ongoing funding dedicated to literacy. What are the goals of the money? How do we fairly and efficiently get these resources to schools? And how do we identify and prioritize student need? So while this proposal doesn't adequately answer all of these questions, it is commendable of the department to be willing to take a hard look at an existing funding formula, something that we should be doing in lots of areas in education finance. Otherwise, we can just keep doing what we've been doing and hope we get different results. We know what that's called, right? Minnesota Nice Legislating. Finally, as many members of this committee are well aware, we have a massive problem with chronic absenteeism in Minnesota. The number of students missing more than 10% of the school year doubled from 2019 to 2022 and hasn't budged much since. The most recent data that we have from the department shows that there are 200,000 chronically absent students. 46,000 of these students have disabilities. And whatever you believe the point of public school is, to teach kids how to read, to give them access to meals or mental health services, or meet the federal civil right to a free, appropriate public education, we got to get the kid into the building in order to achieve that. The student attendance and truancy study group heard time and again this summer and fall about the costs and barriers associated with transportation and its impact on attendance. So will cutting reimbursements for special education transportation make it easier or harder to get students with disabilities to school? Will transportation for services with kids with disabilities simply get worse? Or will this proposal create a new cross-subsidy just when the state was finally starting to make real progress in addressing its existing responsibility to fund services to students? It's not a great outcome for kids either way. I want to thank you all for your time today, and thank you all for your public service to our state.
And thank you for your comments. Ms. Schneider.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Snyder. I represent Education Minnesota. For folks that are new to the committee or new to the legislature, Education Minnesota represents about 84,000 educators. This includes teachers, paraprofessionals, bus drivers, basically anyone who works for a principal is capable of being represented by us. The first item I want to flag today in the governor's budget recommendations is a compensatory hold harmless. And I'm flagging that first for a reason, because I think that's going to be the biggest task in front of this committee, is figuring out a solution here. Without this funding, districts across your districts are going to face cuts. They're going to have to lay off people either in the classroom or the people who support people in the classroom. This is the most important issue that's in front of this committee, in my opinion, this session. With that being said, there seems to be a quicker solution than what's proposed by the governor. He proposes a working group to dive into the issue about how we're identifying kids. And the reality of that will be that you will solve the fiscal cliff districts are facing this budget year and just create another fiscal cliff in the following budget year. I would strongly recommend the committee to consider the bill, House File 31, I believe authored by Lead Joachim, which has essentially brings back paper forms that our districts know and love to administer, but keeps all of our kids in poverty represented in the compensatory revenue. I also want to flag the unemployment compensation revenue refresh. This is helping people who are in the lunchrooms, that are driving our buses, that are helping kids with disabilities even access the bathroom, let alone have differentiated instruction. This is a fantastic use of one-time money, and when we have an opportunity to have ESPs in front of this committee, you will hear about how this has changed people's lives and the retention rates have exploded across the state. A couple of other items I want to flag. For us, our top three priorities are pay, pension, and health care. We strongly oppose the cut to QComp. If you're serving on the Education Policy Committee as well, you'll hear about teacher development and evaluation. This is the only funding in the state that goes to teacher development and evaluation, which all teachers across the state have to be a part of. It's literally dollars in our teachers' pockets, and we hope to continue this conversation. We also are opposed to the transportation special education cuts that matched Mr. Schaefer outlined so beautifully. And as we look at changes to the student support personnel aid, I just want to remind the committee that the plural of anecdote is not data. And when you look at the data, most school districts have been able to use that funding, have been able to hire mental health and physical health people in their districts, and we should keep that in mind before we make any big changes. The other item I wanted to mention was that in a time of great budget shortage, we support the cut to the non-public pupil aid, and that is everything on my list, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Kronquist and Ms. Nisler. And on deck will be the Associate Director for the Educational Quality of Excellence in Archdiocese of St. Paul and the Principal for St. Paul II Catholic School. Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. AMSD represents 53 districts, which include pretty much all the districts in the Seven County metropolitan area and also the large regional center districts of Duluth, St. Cloud, Mankato, and Rochester. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few brief comments on the governor's proposed budget. And also want to mention that I am speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the Minnesota School Board Association today as well, trying to save you some time. You all know, members, your school districts are facing significant budget challenges. I'm sure many of you have heard that, and many of them have already implemented cuts, in fact, to try to get ahead of the game and make preparation for next year's budget. That said, you won't be surprised that we are opposed to the cut in special education transportation reimbursement. In reality, those are costs that are driven by the needs of our students and that our school districts are required to offer. and there really is very little room for districts to reduce those costs, and so in effect it's really going to be shifting that cost from the state to school districts. We are likewise opposed to the elimination of the alternative teacher compensation or QCOMP program. We understand that this has been a challenge over the years because not all school districts receive it. It has been an inequity that's been in our system for some time. We think the better alternative, though, is to look at expanding the program and offering it to more school districts. In fact, there's been a waiting list for a number of years of districts that have been trying to get into that program. We think that program has become even more important with the passage of the READ Act because it provides critical resources that are helpful in implementing the READ Act. Moving on to the compensatory formula modification, first let me say we greatly appreciate the governor recognizing this need and the fact that many school districts were looking at significant reductions due to the change to reliance strictly on direct certification. That said, we hope as you committee members dig into this, you might be able to look at modifying the governor's proposal because, as Ms. Erickson pointed out, the hold harmless is at the pupil level, not the funding level. And so, in fact, a number of districts would actually see less compensatory revenue under this proposal than they would under current law. And so we hope we can smooth that out and try to protect all school districts from this change in compensatory. We also want to thank the governor for including money for unemployment insurance aid to get us through another summer. As you heard, there is not sufficient funds to make it through another summer. And absent something happening this session, then those funds would need to come out of a district's general fund to cover those costs. We hope also that we can eventually find a long-term permanent solution to cover that expense. I do want to just touch also on the literacy incentive aid formula change. We're not necessarily opposed to looking at changes to that formula. However, this proposal would have a distributional impact for school districts. All right, it's neutral to the state, but there will be winners and losers under this proposal. And we think that in this time when districts are working hard to implement the READ Act, this is a critical funding stream. No district can afford to see a reduction in their literacy aid as they are trying to implement the READ Act. So we hope that we can smooth that out. Historically, when the legislature has looked at changes to funding formulas, they've tried to do it in a way that doesn't hurt or harm school districts and instead provide a smoothing effect or a transition aid. And so we hope you'll do the same in this case. And then just the last thing, Mr. Chairman and members, we do appreciate the governor's recognition that some additional flexibility in the student support personnel aid would be helpful. And so with that, I will stop. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Ms. Nisler.
Chair Kreisha and members of the House Education Finance Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the governor's budget proposals, specifically the proposed reductions to special education transportation funding. My name is Heidi Nisler. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Specialized Services for St. Paul Public Schools. Prior to this position, I was a Director of Special Education for Eden Prairie Schools, and prior to that, I was the Director of Special Education for Becker, Big Lake, Monticello, and St. Michael Albertville. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, which is an organization that advocates for the needs of students with disabilities across the state of Minnesota. A theme that has prevailed across my entire career in education is the impact of the special education cross-subsidy in every district. Federal law and state laws require every student with a disability to receive a fair and appropriate public education, and that comes at a significant cost. Over the last few years, the state has seen a dramatic increase in the number of students who qualify for special education services, and the intensity of the needs has greatly increased as well. As a result, the need for special transportation has increased, but that is because that is what the students need. Special transportation is decided by the IEP team, which includes the students' parents. And once a team has decided that special transportation is needed, the district has no choice but to provide that transportation to ensure that a student safely arrives at school. The governor's budget recommendations include a 5% decrease in year one and eventual 10% decrease in future years.
The current special education funding formula is incredibly and needlessly complex. And while we would welcome a conversation about changes to the funding formula as a whole, the current proposal would drastically impact school districts across the state. Districts would still be required to provide special transportation, but instead of the funding coming from the state, instead it would be general education funds or local operating levies that would be required to fund this required specialized service. In my current district of St. Paul Public Schools, we serve over 6,000 students with disabilities. A 5% decrease in special transportation funding would equate to over $800,000. That is 7 special education teachers. That is 20 paraprofessionals. In one of my previous districts of Monticello that serves over 750 students, this would equate to $90,000. That is the cost of a teacher. Across all districts, special education leaders and district leaders are working incredibly hard to contain the costs of special education, but at the end of the day, we have a legal and ethical obligation to ensure every student with a disability has their needs met. I strongly urge you to maintain the current special education funding. And again, we would welcome a conversation about fundamental changes to the special education funding formula to create a less complex and more transparent funding formula. But the current formula, the current proposal would result in a negative impact on our school districts, and most importantly, our students with disabilities across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
And thank you. And with that, if we can get the Associate Director for the Archdiocese of St. Paul to come up, as well as the principal from John Paul, and brevity would get you points with me right now, because I'm a little behind.
Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Meg Forgette, and I am an Associate Director for the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis's Office for Catholic Education. Prior to this role, I spent 13 years as a school psychologist in multiple public schools here in the Twin Cities. Catholic schools in our Archdiocese alone serve more than 30,000 students across 49 public school districts and represent great diversity. 31% of our students are not Catholic, 28% of our students are students of color, while 13% of our students qualify for free or reduced meals. We also serve a variety of learning needs through multiple in-house programs, including a multi-tiered intensive reading program at St. John's of Little Canada, as well as the Nicholas Center at Hill Murray High School that serves neurodivergent students with complex disabilities. While we have many other schools serving students with diverse learning needs, these two provide excellent examples of how our schools welcome and support students and families with all types of needs and backgrounds while saving the state additional funds to educate rather than further exacerbating the cross-subsidy challenge across our school districts that we know of. The average cost to educate across our entire system is per student is $8,532. As of 2024, while the average cost to educate for public schools in Minnesota is over $18,000 per student. With over 30,000 students in our archdiocesan system alone, which is just one part of the state, we are saving the state's education system a significant amount of money each year. So why then would it make any sense to cut the non-public per pupil aid program as well as non-public transportation from the state's budget? This proposal needs to be removed as it is not effective in bringing more financial vitality to the state of Minnesota, as well as it is simply discriminatory against non-public students, not schools, but students. It will also cause significant equity issues in making it harder for students of lower income families to choose a school that fully fits their children's needs and family values. Transportation is often critical for them and will impact these families by far the greatest. If these students are forced to go back to their public schools, not only will they cost the state more money to educate, but they will also further increase the need for multiple intervention services and support while increasing the likelihood of exacerbating the achievement gap. While we have many students of diverse backgrounds and socioeconomic statuses across our system, our 9 Drexel Mission schools continue to serve families from a variety of ethnic backgrounds as well. An average of 87% of these students are of color, 38% are English language learners, and 69% of students qualify for free and reduced meals. Our Drexel Mission School students, many of whose families pay less than $1,000 annually per year in tuition, are given not only a quality education, but also the wraparound services needed by their students and their families to access basic needs, clothing, food, etc. Governor Walz and his administration has stressed quality education for all Minnesota children, as well as the need for their overall wellness, including their mental and physical health. These per pupil aid dollars and transportation are the only source of direct government support for our non-public students in these key areas. What a beautiful opportunity this could be for our state government and MDE to ensure that true equity and inclusion are shown for all families and learners, including those who choose non-public education while also paying the same taxes as their public school neighbors. Please do not allow the governor's budget to discriminate against non-public students and their families who play such a critical role in the life and the vitality of our education system and state. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tricia Menshuber, and I am honored to serve as principal of St. John Paul II Catholic School in Northeast Minneapolis. I have served in this role for 8 years, but it's my 23rd year in education as a licensed teacher and administrator in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for being here today, for your service and your openness to hearing about how Minnesota's support for all school children is so important to our collective work of raising young people to be positive contributors and innovators in our communities. At JP2, we serve 208 scholars, kindergarten through eighth grade, with another 20 children in our Early Childhood Learning Center. 88% are students of color, and 76% meet the federal threshold for free and reduced lunches. We admit all students who apply. The majority of our families live on the margins of society. As you can surmise, most of our scholars are first-generation college-bound students, so guidance counseling in middle school plays a key and crucial role. For example, our eighth-grade students are the ones who often fill out their own registration information for high school, many of them at public and charter schools in the area, and they lead their parents through the process of accessing a secondary education. And this is supported by our district-provided guidance counselor who teaches them about high school options and helps them with entrance requirements. And the very best news is, in Northeast Minneapolis Urban Core, 100% of our eighth graders graduate high school in 4 years. This is remarkable. None of this would be possible without state-funded guidance counseling to help our scholars be high school ready. And this is only about an hour a week for seventh and eighth graders. Just a little goes so far. Our state-funded nurse serves our scholars for less than 2 days a month with an option to call for support when needed. We do not have the funds for outside health services, so this nurse becomes pivotal in helping us work with families and children. She trains our school support staff, like me, to handle basic medical emergencies, basic aid, medication, immunization reporting, etc. So we become the health aides in the building, and she is our expert. It is important to note that non-public pupil aides are direct essential services provided to students, not funds for operation. I cannot imagine how we would keep our scholars safe and healthy without even this minimal service. It's good for our school, of course, but also the health of our local community. I believe that we do this work collectively, all of our schools and community members, all of our scholars and families, all of you contribute. Non-public pupil aides and state support has been critical to our work with the urban youth of Northeast Minneapolis, and I hope you see today that we utilize these funds effectively to move the dial on scholar achievement and future success. We urge your committee and the entire state legislature to continue to preserve these essential services for all children in Minnesota. Thank you.
And thank you. And I have about 8 minutes left for six testifiers. So for the next ones, if you can keep it close to a minute, that'd be great. I have the Vice President for Advancement of Ascension Catholic Academy and the Principal for Notre Dame Academy. And I will have to cut people off at about a minute if I'm going to make my agenda.
Chair Carisha, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Quentin Moore. I serve as the Vice President of Advancement for Ascension Catholic Academy. As I stated last week at the Minnesota Senate Education Finance Committee meeting, we stand at a crossroads in education. The proposed elimination of non-public pupil education aid and transportation aid will have far-reaching consequences, not just for private school families, but for our collective goal as Minnesota taxpayers and citizens in improving academic outcomes for our entire state. Personally, as a product of Catholic education, first-generation college grad, and someone who's built a life working and living in North Minneapolis, I know firsthand the transformative power of access to a quality school. This is not a debate about public and private education. It's about educational freedom, fiscal responsibility, and ensuring every scholar and family has critical tools and resources to pursue prosperity and excellence. At Ascension Catholic Academy, I witness the impact of strong educational ecosystem every day, combining public, private, corporate, philanthropic support, both in financial generosity and volunteer time. We've seen the benefits of co-creating a model that strengthens personal development and academic attainment of our scholars. Our four schools, Ascension Catholic School in North Minneapolis, St. John Paul II in Northeast Minneapolis, St. Peter Claver here in the heart of the Rondo neighborhood, and St. Paschal Regional on the east side of St. Paul, all serve a diverse, resilient community of more than 700 plus scholars annually. 96% of our scholars identify as scholars of color, 68% qualify for free and reduced lunch, 17% are English language learners, and 45% identify as Catholic.
And Mr. Moore, about 20 seconds, I'm sorry.
Thank you so much, Chair. I'll say in light of this, our scholars consistently outperform their neighborhood schools. 100% have gone on to graduate high school in 4 years since 2013, and the impact that that has on breaking cycles of poverty is significant. The majority of them go on to attend college and pursue post-secondary opportunities. I really hope that you all will consider opposing the elimination, not just a cut, but the elimination of non-public pupil aid. It doesn't make sense fiscally. It doesn't make sense for our scholars and our families that we serve, and it will have tremendous detrimental impact to those non-public scholars and families. So again, I appreciate your time. I didn't get through my full speech, but trust me when I tell you that we are saving scholars' lives. We are making an impact on families who are at the margins. This non-public pupil aid makes all the difference. So I implore you to oppose these cuts. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Ms. Jungles.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Bonnie Jungles, and I am currently the principal at Notre Dame Academy in Minnetonka. I am in my 18th year serving Minnesota families as a Catholic school administrator. I am here to share my concern about the proposed budget cuts to non-public pupil aid. These cuts will have a huge negative impact on all families in Minnesota. One of the greatest assets of our state is that we offer so many incredible school choices. My own three children, now adults, attended three different high schools, public and private, as each child desired a different school setting to meet their unique personalities and needs. These choices allowed each of them to flourish in many ways. My great-grandfather, John Kinzer, spent 28 years as a Democratic legislator serving in the Minnesota House of Representatives, working to ensure that the future would be bright for our families and children. A dairy farmer from Stearns County with 14 children of his own, he understood the importance of education, something that was not always easily accessible for his own children. My grandma said that many days during the harsh Minnesota winters, she was not able to attend school because of the more than 2-mile walk to get there.
And I'm sorry, about 20 seconds, please.
John Kinzer, in fact, sponsored and championed the original bill to provide transportation for non-public students as a means to fairness and equity for all families in our state. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for all you are doing to continue the incredible work my great-grandfather immersed himself in to ensure our children have an amazing future, one that allows non-public schools to continue to provide opportunities for our children, including my grandsons, to thrive and flourish. It is imperative that Minnesota continues the long-standing tradition that many representatives fought for years of providing crucial funding for non-public schools, thus continuing our incredible asset of offering an amazing array of school choices. Minnesota students who are provided all essential educational opportunities to succeed will become our strongest community members and greatest leaders of the future. They will be the next generation of representatives sitting in your seats. I appreciate your time and consideration.
And thank you. Mr. Benz, Mr. Beckering, and Ms. Weiss, West, W-E-S-S. Make sure you get that right. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Benz.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tim Benz, and I am president of MINdependent. We are the largest statewide advocacy and membership organization serving the non-public schools in the state. We currently have 180 member schools that educate more than 41,000 students, and thousands of educators and support staff are employed there. A colleague of mine often says, when you've seen one non-public school, you've seen one non-public school. For context, there are more than 460 non-public schools in the state educating more than 73,000 students. In fact, there are approximately 40 non-public schools located in districts of the members in this committee. By using simple table napkin math based on the state's per pupil allocation, students attending non-public schools save the state nearly $500 million each year. As noted, beginning in 1969, Minnesota legislature made a commitment to transport students of their school of choice, regardless of sector. Minnesota furthered that by committing non-public pupil aids in 1975 so that every school pupil in the state will share equitably in education benefits. Minnesota advanced this common good theory with the free school meals for all last year in 2023 when non-public schools were included in there. As I reflect on the services that invest in Minnesota students and families, I'll point out Minnesota is not an outlier in this. Several states have these same programs in place. For more than five decades, regardless of legislative makeup or budget situations, non-public pupil aids and transportation have endured. Governor Walz's recent budget proposal, he proposes eliminating all of them. As illustrated by our testifiers today, this has seismic impacts on students and families.
And about 30 seconds.
Perfect. Two administrators commented to me who could not be here to testify. Randy Fifley down in Edgerton, Minnesota, in a rural area, as he commented regarding the loss of transportation, he quipped, "Dairy cows cannot delay their milking times." In addition, Franklin Academy, a school that serves neurodiverse students in Golden Valley, uses their transportation reimbursement to provide for their needs of their students on the autism spectrum. A recent administrator who just recently retired made a comment about the current educational environment, and they said, a lot of people say we're all in the same boat. And he said, but rather we should say we're all in different boats, but in the same storm. In closing, I encourage members of this committee to protect these services and do not discriminate against students and families who choose a non-public educational setting. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Beckering. And Good Mr. afternoon, Collison, if you would prepare as well.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Beckering. I serve as the head of school of Southwest Christian High School in Chaska, where we serve 545 students, 41 different communities, and 88 churches. I also serve as the Minnesota State Representative for the Association of Christian Schools International, or ACSI, which encompasses 33 member schools throughout our state, collectively serving 8,000 students. The families who choose our ACSI schools are seeking an educational environment that aligns with and nurtures their Christian values and beliefs. I'm a firm believer that our state's education system is strengthened by the diverse options it offers, public, private, and faith-based schools, empowering families to make the best choices for their children. However, many Minnesota families face financial barriers that prevent them from accessing a faith-based education. For example, our schools serve single-parent households with incomes around $25,000 or two-parent households with a combined income of about $45,000. Despite tremendous sacrifices on these families' parts, they depend on substantial tuition assistance to enroll in our schools. We're trying to keep our schools affordable despite cutting costs and paying our employees less than what they would make in the public school sector. Governor Waltz's proposal is going to keep more families from having a choice in where they send their students.
And 30 seconds.
I just want to end by drawing your attention to Minnesota Statute 123B40. Mr. Benz just mentioned it. It reads, this statute, it clearly states, it is the intent of the legislature to provide for the distribution of educational aids such as textbooks, standardized tests, and pupil support services so that every school pupil in the state will share equitably in educational benefits and therefore further assure all Minnesota pupils and their parents freedom of choice in education. That was the purpose. Governor Waltz's proposal takes us the opposite direction. It undoes 50 years of commitment to all students in our state. I implore this committee on behalf of Minnesota's 33 ACSI schools not to deny private school students these essential services simply because their parents exercise their freedom of choice in education. Please do not support proposals that diminish the freedom of Minnesota families to select the educational path they believe as parents is best for their children. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. And Ms. West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee. My name is Ann Weiss. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools, also known as MAISE. And I'm here today to express concern about proposed cuts to the non-public pupil aid and non-public pupil transportation aid. Currently, MAISE schools receive just under $3 million annually in non-public aid and non-public pupil transportation aid. This funding is critical for our students. Importantly, the dollars we receive in aid follow the students by providing transportation, educational materials, access to health services, and for some of our students, counseling services. As many of our school leaders have shared over the last couple weeks, elimination of non-public aid would disproportionately affect our low-income families by increasing textbook expenses, instructional material costs, and busing costs. It is unlikely that a number of these families would be able to stay in any of our schools. Reducing non-public pupil aid and transportation aid could limit access to essential resources like instructional materials, our counseling services, and transportation. All of these play a vital role in supporting student access to education and, in turn, student success. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
And thank you. And thank you, everyone. And the final public testifier, Mr. Tolleson. Is he here?
Might be stuck in the Senate.
Okay. Okay. Last call, Mr. Tolleson. All right. Thank you very much for the testifiers. Appreciate it. I know we're a little pressed for time. I do have a list for questions for the members. And if the commissioner and your staff, if I can invite you back up to the table. Representative Hudson, you're number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quite a stunning budget proposal from the governor. Cuts funding to teachers' pay, cuts funding for services with children with special needs. After 2 years of rhetoric about banning books, it denies textbooks to school-aged children. And it does all this while increasing funding for the staff at MDE. But there's one specific item related to the funding request that I'd like to examine a little bit more closely. The governor's requesting $6 million for legal fees. Now, I understand this follows previous appropriations to MDE for more than $14 million for past legal fees. And we're all familiar with the Cruz-Guzman case, but I presume these funds are also used in other legal disputes, including the civil case between the Minnesota Department of Education and the nonprofit Feeding Our Future. As I understand the record, Feeding Our Future sued MDE in November of 2020, and MDE entered into a stipulation agreement with Feeding Our Future, and a protracted legal battle ensued for what I believe was about 20 months. So my first question for the department is, how much money has MDE paid for litigation costs related to the defense of what we now know to be an utterly brazen and frivolous lawsuit?
And Mr. Hudson, Representative Hudson, I think you meant to come through the chair, so I'll go to Commissioner Jett.
Chair, excuse me, Chair, members, and thank you for the question. And I know that that trial that you mentioned is ongoing. So I'm going to turn that to our Mr. Adoshuni.
Mr. Uni.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hudson, I'm certainly happy to get the information, but I think the department and we talking about in hearing and education policy, we want to be extremely careful about any contemplation in as it pertains to litigation, especially as it pertains to anything that could relate to the trials that are ongoing now. So I'm happy to have a discussion about this and provide the information. I also don't have those any of those figures right on me, so it will have to require some follow-up, but we're a bit limited in what we can discuss in terms of details here.
Representative Hudson, follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I know that from looking at the court records and previous statements from the department, mostly from Commissioner Jett's predecessor, that the fraud likely began after March of 2020 as the pandemic was setting in, and the FBI began their investigation around May of 2021. So my next question would be, can MDE provide an accounting for how much money was paid out to the defendants between March of 2020 and April of 2021, and how much money might have been paid out in the months following April of 2021 until the money finally stopped?
And Mr. Rooney, would you like me to go right to you or Ms.
Chair? Yes, please.
Mr. Rooney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hudson, it's not that I can't go back to the team and find that information in due time. We are limited in what we can discuss as it relates to that case due to the ongoing trial right now.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So finally, I just want to turn to the court records surrounding the civil case, which I find very interesting, and they're available for folks to look up. You have to consider the audacity of a criminal enterprise suing a state agency because that agency is not paying out money fast enough to fund their fraud. But what I find most interesting is that in the many court documents relating to this case, spanning at least those 20 months, the only entity that was accused of taking food from children was MDE. In a court document from November of 2021, MDE was accused of taking a bag of groceries, an odd accusation. In response, MDE said in the court case, quote, its employees are instructed not to take food unless refusal would create an awkward situation, unquote. The court's response seemed pretty dead on. They said, quote, it seems to the court a great deal more awkward for MDE leadership to explain to the public why its regulators are accepting gifts from regulated entities identical in form to public assistance to which they do not qualify, unquote. And then they closed out with this, quote, the court suggests MDE would also instill in the whole far more confidence in the citizens MDE serves that public assistance to by regulating it's actually going to those in need who qualify for it. So I say all of this just to leave the committee with the point that if we're going to consider this governor's request for an additional $6 million for litigation costs, we should probably examine how effectively the previous appropriations have protected the state's legal interests.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Any comments?
Chair, members, no.
Okay. And with that, Chair Uakim, I'm going to turn it to you for the last comments and probably to take us out, so I'll give you the remainder of the time.
Okay, thank you. Just quick questions, just because I'm trying to understand how some of the savings were found in the governor's budget. Would the reduction in the non-public pupil aid affect just particularly the non-public pupil aid for transportation affects the savings in transportation sparsity for some of our public school districts then? Because I know that has been a big issue, especially in our rural districts that are very sparse. We do a transportation sparsity aid categorical that had been stuck at 17% reimbursement, and now it's 30. Did you take that into account for calculations when you found the savings for that piece?
Commissioner Jett.
Chair Uakim, members. Chair Uakim. Chair Crescia.
Yes.
Gotcha. And members, I'm going to have the explanation for that answer, Representative Uakim, with Kathy Erickson.
Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
The non-public pupil transportation aid calculation is actually a per pupil formula that uses the second prior year actual expenditures based on the current year transportation. So the reduction that you're seeing in the change page just relates directly to that calculation and does not take into account the transportation sparsity piece, unless, of course, it reduces the amount of miles totally for each independent school district.
Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Erickson. I know that would probably make a big difference for Bemidji Schools that has to transport kids from basically St. Michael Albertville to Stillwater in their geographical map. So I was just wondering about that. Quick also, too, with the reduction in A, and maybe this is a Mr. Strom question, with the reduction of the SPED reimbursement from 195 and then to 90. How is that going to be affect the special education, not build back, but that if districts could then put that toward their special education costs, and then how would that affect the reimbursement and then also the 50% of the cross subsidy that we pay for?
Commissioner.
Chair, members, I will rely on our content expert.
Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the special education component pieces of the amounts that were forecasted as reductions came from utilizing past year data and then forecasting into the future data. One thing that I do want to mention is that we are seeing a significant growth in transportation costs overall from the time of the pandemic until now, and we're also seeing an increased cost in the number of contracted special education transportation costs versus district-owned, which can have a variable that increases the cost of special education transportation. And so, again, the 95 and 90% calculations were based on estimates that we have in relation to special education transportation costs and then how we moved it forward to make sure that those could be considered. But also considering the increased cost of transportation, we are seeing more money going out overall in transportation in this year and forecasted into future years.
Chair Youakim.
Thank you. Just one last maybe more comment, too. I would like to thank the governor for putting that one-time money into UI to get us through the next this summer, then the next summer. We do have 50% in the base for special education billing that would doesn't kick in until that UI money is gone. So that's super helpful to keep those costs down as in special education as well. And I just want to thank Representative Cresha. I think it was a very good first meeting. I look forward to more.
Thank you. Thank you, members. I know we were a little rushed in the testifiers. Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll be able to allow expansion of questions and discussion as we go. So, members, that concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting, and if you notice, the public safety is being very passive-aggressive by sticking their heads in, so we know you're here. Our next meeting will be Thursday, February 13th, and with that, we stand adjourned.